This is the Illegal Curve Hockey Show.
The podcast
on TSN1290.ca.
Good evening, Winnipeg. Good evening, Manitoba. And for all those that are joining us live at TSN1290.ca, good evening, universe, and welcome to NHL Midweek with the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. I'm your host, Drew Mandel, joined in studio by my colleagues Richard Pollock and Ezra Ginsberg. Producer Remus is on loan to us from Rick Ralph and the Rona Roundtable. 2 hours of hockey talk for you on this Wednesday night. Coming up in about 30 minutes' time, Corey Massasak from NHL.com will join us. He was in Sochi, Russia for the Olympic Games. He's going to join us to talk about those games, do a post-mortem analysis of all that went down in the Olympic hockey tournament. At 7 p.m. tonight, Tyson Nash, the Phoenix Coyotes color analyst on Fox Sports Arizona, is going to join us. Obviously, the Jets return to action tomorrow evening against the Coyotes. Tyson will join us to preview that matchup. You can follow us on Twitter at Illegal Curve, Facebook.com/Illegal Curve, and our website with the latest Winnipeg Jets and NHL news is illegalcurve.com. But without further ado, I say good evening to my colleagues Richard and Ezra. Gentlemen, you're both looking fine. You're both looking well. Welcome to the program. We're getting the mic problems off to start.
That was brilliant. Yeah. That was just hilarious. As his mic's already broken, we haven't even started. Well, I want to. Well, let me quickly, start, including Ezzy in this story. I'm on my way to the show and quickly stopping for a coffee at Tim Hortons, and I'm end up in line in the drive thru behind one Ezra Ginsberg. So I'm always interested to see what Ezzy's going to order, right? You know, he likes to change it up every once in a while. So yeah, I hear medium. I can hear through the window because my window's down. I hear medium coffee, one cream, one sugar, and the and always gets you, right? What's Ezzy going to throw in there in the end? He goes, and the new crispy chicken sandwich. So he's got. So he got off to a great start before the show, but the oddest part is, I was expecting Ezzy maybe to pay it forward. Would it be you paying it forward if you paid for my order?
Yes.
Yeah, paying it forward. Sure. Ezzy paid it backwards.
He charged you for it.
I got up there. It was like $20 bill.
That's definitely not true. By the way, just for the record, before the show started, I asked Remus if that mic worked.
That's true.
And he said that it was working, and that for those
you should have seen his face when it didn't work. Yeah,
for those at home, basically the middle mic here at TSN 1290 Studios hasn't been working, so I've been using the mic that's usually reserved for Remus.
There's two middle mics, you and this mic and Michael Remus, and they're both not working so far.
Yeah, that's well done there, Richie. That's a good
point. Yeah, long story short, the crispy chicken sandwich at Tim Hortons is great.
Thanks for clarifying that. I didn't know they had a crispy chicken sandwich. So you're learning something new every day here on NHL Midweek with the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. Gentlemen, let's get started by looking back to Sunday morning and Team Canada's performance in the gold medal victory over Team Sweden. First hour of the show is we're going to do our post-mortem. We're going to do our analysis of the Olympic hockey tournament. The second hour will be dedicated to the Winnipeg Jets and the playoff push, which of course gets underway with tomorrow evening's game against the Phoenix Coyotes, game you can hear live on TSN 1290. They won handily on Sunday morning. It was, obviously 3-0. It was not very dramatic. It was not very stressful, I thought. But still, there's something about that, just exemplifies the dominance they showed. And it sort of took us a couple weeks, maybe not a couple weeks because the tournament isn't that long, but it took us maybe a week of the tournament to realize just how dominant this Team Canada team actually was in the course of the six games that were played in Sochi at the Olympics.
I really thought that they were going to be this dominant before the tournament started. And a lot of people were picking Russia, not just to medal, but to win gold.
Like Drew.
And Richie and I both didn't have them meddling, and I don't want to say that we're know-it-alls or we really know what we're talking about. No, but in all seriousness, this really was a perfect team. And you talk about that Sunday gold medal game that really still has people talking, and the game plan for Team Canada really was perfect, and it worked out perfectly. And this team really didn't have any flaws. The fact that Carey Price got shutouts in the semifinals and gold medal game is truly incredible, because the issue was goaltending for this team, even though I didn't think it was as big of an issue, Richie, as other people did.
I'm with you on that.
This team really didn't have that many hiccups. They won every game, and sure, that you might might have liked to have seen more goals scored. But as we talked about last Saturday when we were previewing the gold medal game, there were so many players that were due. And the three main guys that were due, Jonathan Toews, Chris Kunitz, Sidney Crosby, got on the score sheet, got their first goals of the tournament. This team was just too good. No other country could handle the Canadian forwards up front, and really nobody had any type of answer to the group of six defensemen that played consistently for Team Canada. I thought Sweden was intimidated, quite frankly, in that game. They just didn't seem to generate much, and when they did generate, it was from the outsides. Sure, they were missing players, but Richie, Canada was missing Tavares and Stamkos.
That's right.
Stamkos for the whole tournament and Tavares for the last two plus games because he went out in the quarterfinals. So really, this team was a perfect team. And after the tournament, now what we're starting to hear is, was that the most dominant team that Canada has ever put together for the Olympics? And you could really make a strong argument that it was.
You could. I mean, and people, it's amazing to me the way the narrative changes over the course of a week. Will the team win to greatest team ever? I'm not saying it's not saying it's unwarranted, but I just find it interesting the way that changes so quickly. I thought this was a great team. I thought this team was well coached, well prepared. They all bought into that team concept. I think that even goes back to that we've talked about on the show many times, the Claude Giroux not going to the orientation camp. Seeing the buy-in of this team just the past couple weeks makes me think even more that was a factor because of how everybody bought in here. Subban didn't play, bought in. Deschamps smiling, bought in. St. Louis, you saw an emotional interview with Elliot Friedman after the game on Sunday. Great interview, I thought. Bought in. Didn't play a shift against the U.S., but was still willing to you know, get ready to go, and he played an instrumental role, I thought, in Sunday's game. But, you know, Drew, is it the best team? I don't know. I thought it was a great group of six defensemen. I thought it was forwards who were willing to back check, and I thought it was forwards that didn't score a lot. And people keep saying, now again, this is the whole story. The storylines always change. Canada still really couldn't score at the tournament ended, but because they were playing so well defensively, that became the storyline.
Sure.
But they had the chances and they had the shots. So they really ought to have scored.
Mm-hmm.
So this team, I thought, best team ever. Great team, maybe, but you could argue. I don't know, best team ever. I don't really know about those arguments. But the point is, this team actually could have been better to me. They could have been better because they could have scored more. And they had chances to score more. They did.
And Richie, with the exception of special players, and you're talking about Wayne Gretzky, the power play wasn't good. They had the fewest power plays of any country in the tournament. But when you're talking about dominant offensive players when it's best on best,
right,
you don't see too many of those. Yeah, there's the Gretzkys, there's the Burrays, there's the Lemieux. But it kind of proved that nobody on any country was really dominant. Yeah, Phil Kessel came into the semifinal game playing really well, and he was obviously named to the all-tournament team as a forward, but really, it's really rare that you have a forward, even in this day and age, when you have superstar forwards, and the majority of them were in the tournament, a few of them weren't there, but really, it shows you that you win as a team, and it doesn't really matter who scores. The games are going to be close. And
well, that's the thing. And on that point about the games being close, I mean, this is what they were. I thought the pace of the Canada games was pretty good for the most part, but the other games were pretty bad. And we talk about the Olympics. We wait 4 years for the Olympics, but the quality of game, I thought, on an overall basis, was poor.
Do you attribute that to the ice surface? Not the quality of ice, but the larger Olympic ice surface.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah, Matt, that's certainly probably a fairly significant factor, Drew. But
because can the Finns the Swiss for sure, and the Finns and the Latvians, can they play that 1-0 style
on
a North
American? They play the same way.
The Swedes didn't open. They only opened it up when they were trailing.
But I mean, how many teams really opened it up? Canada didn't even open up. Really, they're just that talented. And the way they played wasn't opening up. I'm not saying they ought to have. I'm just saying The quality of their game against the U.S. was a great game. I don't care if it was 1-0 or not. It was a great game, pace-wise, excitement-wise, all that.
Still a dominating performance, though.
That was a Stanley Cup playoff game.
Yeah, it was a game 7, and it was a dominating performance. But aside from that game, and maybe the U.S.-Russia game, can you remember a game in this tournament?
Can
you remember a game?
No, you can't. They were pretty dull.
That's a problem.
Well, and that, I think, is a factor of the way the teams play in the tournament, the majority of teams, which is just shut it down, lock it down, and the ice surface, being the international ice surface, allows them to play that style. I mean, if Canada had played Latvia on a North American ice surface, it's not a 2-1 game.
Yeah, probably not, Drew, but if you remember 2010, they had trouble beating those teams. They couldn't beat Switzerland on a regular ice surface.
Sure, they went to a shootout.
Yeah, well, you know, in the shootout they beat them, but the point is... Yeah. It didn't change it that much. I mean, you put five guys in any ice surface, but below the blue line, there's so much room.
Yeah, it's a fair point on the room. You know, Nicklas Backstrom, obviously, you know, a blow to Sweden 2 hours before puck drop.
It wouldn't have mattered.
It wouldn't have made a difference?
No, no. So they lost. No. I don't think. Then
maybe if they had six Nicklas Backstroms.
Yeah, maybe. Sweden wasn't beating Canada. I don't care if they had Zetterberg, they weren't beating Canada. I mean, they couldn't create anything. What you would consider scoring chances were not actually scoring chances by Sweden. In that game, they were being given scoring chances scoring chances were counted that weren't really, to me, scoring chances because they're trying to make it look like it was closer than it was.
The best scoring chance was the one in the first period that hit the post and Carey
Price.
Yeah,
that was off Mark Edward Vlasic falling in the corner, and then Nyquist was darting to the net, and then Doughty going to pursue his guy behind the net. But if Vlasic doesn't fall, they don't have a scoring chance, really.
Ray Shiro, the Pittsburgh Penguins general manager, and then he became the de facto U.S. general manager with David Poyle's injury.
That's terrible. Though.
Terrible injury. Yeah. Spoke about Team Canada after the tournament. Here's what Ray Shiro had to say.
I think the credit's got to go to Canada. These guys were really, really good. And there's no denying that fact. And, you know, that might be the greatest Olympic hockey team ever. And to take a look at that and how they played the game, and their goalie was good, but their defense was fantastic. And they were big, they were strong, they were mobile. And Dan mentioned, you know, their fourth line, you know, you got Matt Duchene and Rick Nash, and they were just deep, deep, deep. And
bear it out. They outscored their opponents 17-3. They never trailed at any point in the tournament. They outshot their opponents 241 shots to 129. Is Ray Shiro right? And that it might be the greatest Olympic hockey team ever?
Yeah, I think it might be. And again, I agree with Richie, though. I don't know what, I mean, unless you're really talking about Gretzky, Jordan, the greatest. Like, I'm serious. These guys are the greatest. What really does it serve to call it the greatest? The point is, it's definitely one of the greatest, if not the greatest. But coming from Ray Shiro, what a compliment from Ray Shiro. But this team, I mean, for all the talk of Canada being scared that they were going to get shut out by Sweden, that they were going to get shut out by Switzerland, and it was going to happen like it happened in 2006. The difference in Sochi, Richie, and Turin is that this team, unlike the team in 2006, did not have a flaw. In 2006, they lacked certain elements. They didn't take the right players.
And this team had 2006 to look back on.
Right. And this team that was picked by Steve Yzerman, and they started this process years ago, it really didn't have one single flaw. You couldn't look at any single player, and sure, maybe Duchene and St. Louis didn't have any points. They didn't play a lot.
The weaknesses really on this team, Ezzy, if any at all, were considered to be goal, which I thought was overblown, and left side defense, and Baumeister and Vlasic played tremendously well. So those are the only quote-unquote possible weaknesses, but they're not really weaknesses. I mean, you're talking about number one pairing defenseman on NHL teams. And nobody else could match them defensively in terms of just their defense. Never mind the buy-in. I thought the biggest difference in this tournament from every other tournament I've seen was Babcock could have said whatever he wanted. If he would have said, you guys lie down in front of the net on top of each other and the goalie would be in front of you, they would have done it. They bought into whatever he was selling. And that's why, to me, he's the best coach in the league since Scotty Bowman.
I agree with that. Two Canadian golds back-to-back for the first time since the 1950s. That's not an easy thing to do.
No.
And he seemed to always have the right strategy. He always seemed to say the right things before that's and after the games. This team was just on point. They were on point. They were always in control. Every single game, they were in control.
Was there any controversy?
No. Nope.
Did anybody who didn't play complain?
Nope.
Did anybody say something about ice time?
Nope.
Did the goalies complain? It's all about playing time, all that stuff. You know what? Media. Did he say something about a certain player that gave the media a story? He didn't, but yet he answers the media. He's one of the coaches who actually gives you an answer, but doesn't create controversy. It's hard to do that. Most coaches say nothing. Most coaches who listen to them, the tape, might as well turn it off. They say nothing.
Look what was going on in some of the other teams. You had the Czech Republic that were infighting.
Sweden.
You had the problems with Sweden. and on Canada.
And the U.S. was infighting after they lost, too.
Yeah.
They just put their Dustin hockey
Brown.
Equipment on.
Yeah, Dustin Brown threw Dan Bylsma under the bus.
They stepped on the ice every game and got the job done.
Let's go to break. When we come back, we'll continue on the Olympic lines. We'll talk about the winners and losers from the Olympics and whose legacy improves with Canada's gold medal victory. You're listening to NHL Midweek. We're live on TSN 1290.
NHL Midweek.
TSN 1290.
You're listening to
The Illegal Curve Hockey Show.
The podcast
on TSN1290.ca.
Welcome back to NHL Midweek here on TSN 1290, TSN1290.ca. Coming up in about 10 minutes' time, Corey Massasek from NHL.com is going to join us to talk about the Olympic hockey tournament. We continue with our recap of the tournament. Gentlemen, the legacy. And we talked about the monkey on the back and how if Canada didn't win gold, and we talked about this on Saturday's Illegal Curve Hockey Show, it'd be a black mark against Sidney Crosby if he didn't score and they didn't win gold. Obviously, he checked the scoring
before,
off.
That was before Friday's game. That was Wednesday's show.
Was that last Wednesday's show?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. I can't remember. The days seem to blur together.
Well, when you're 85, it's tough to remember.
Yeah, you're getting a little bit old. You're lucky I remember the name of the show. Anyways, Sidney Crosby obviously scored on Sunday, the breakaway goal to make it 2-0. And, you know, so how does his legacy change as a result of the gold medal win?
It continues to go up. It continues to ascend into, you know, past, probably into the Yzerman category right now. I mean, he's projected kind of to follow that path. That Yzerman-Sackett kind of path. The Gretzky-Lemieux path is the next level. But Crosby's going to land amongst those guys right now, as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, and there might never be anybody that's on the Gretzky or Lemieux level. Crosby's close, but I think you have to really take it up another notch, and he's going to have 120, 130-point seasons, which, by the way, he's on pace for 100-plus points this year. But
another cup, too, for sure, at least one.
Right, yeah, and you're talking multiple cups and all that, but... Yeah, he wins another gold. He's already got the Stanley Cup. And, you know, even though he only had 3 points in the tournament, he was still very effective. And he could have had more points. But he still led along with Jonathan Toews, who is arguably the best two-way player in the world. So Crosby's a winner. And, sure, you're going to remember that he wasn't as dominant as maybe you would have expected him to be. But he's still a huge winner in this.
And Jonathan,
I don't think his legacy is that much... affected by it.
Jonathan Toews, as he mentions, I mean, where do you put him now? I mean, his legacy, just a winner. I mean, he's the Messier of his generation. Again, you need more cups to be the Messier, but you're the next level and you're closest thing to it right now. To Messier.
And again, Richie, Jonathan Toews gets one goal, 2 assists, just like Crosby, 3 points.
Mm-hmm.
Doesn't matter. The way that he led...
He better defensively,
too. The way that he played defensively, how good he was on faceoffs, how good he was with Marlowe and Jeff Carter... Just, he was so consistent, and he was a huge part of that leadership group, along with Shea Weber and others, and he makes it look easy, and he just goes out there, and he never has a bad game. Jonathan Toews never has a bad game, and that goes in the NHL, too. He's, sure, in last year's playoffs, he had some bumps and all that, but we know how that turned out.
At the end, he still was hoisting the cup at the end of those playoffs, even in spite of all those bumps.
He's a winner, and he just wins everything. The guy wins. I mean... I've been able to see him play since he was at UND, and the guy's never changed the way he plays. Nothing flashy, but everything's right.
Yeah.
He's Patrice Bergeron on steroids, really is what he is. Just everything a little bit better. Both great players, both winners, both won cups, both won World Juniors, both won Olympics. He's just Patrice Bergeron a little better.
So, you know, obviously we have the Team Canada winners, and it's hard to, you know, they're all great winners. Who's another winner in this tournament in your mind?
One more for Team Canada, then I want to get Carey Price, because I think too many people have doubted him. And I think he's finally received the recognition, to me, I believe has been due for a while. So I think Carey Price in terms of Team Canada. Now, in terms of the other teams, Drew, I mean... I guess you look at probably Tuukka Rask as being a guy who adds to it in terms of how well he played when he had the opportunity. Now, the flu obviously did not allow him for him to play in the semifinal game, and who knows what would have happened. And I love Kari Lehtinen, so I don't think he was the issue, although you could argue with the Carlson goal. But 2-1 game, you're not really going to argue with the goaltending. He was great, I thought. He allowed them to play. You know, you talk all about the style of play, Latvia, Finland. And unless you get 40 saves, then it doesn't matter what style you play. So I thought Tuukka Rask really, he's already had, you know, this is another guy who has taken, no, it was Tim Thomas who won that cup. Rask took him to game six last year.
Right.
But I think it just, it cemented his standing in the National Hockey League in terms of goaltending, because people sometimes question him as he, in terms of playing behind the Bruins and the defense and all that stuff.
Yeah, I agree. And Martin Brodeur has faced that same criticism as well, but it's kind of ridiculous in my opinion. Two winners for me on a team that isn't Canadian, both play on the same NHL team. Two huge winners, both playing for the Minnesota Wild, Michael Granlund and Ryan Suter.
Coming out party for Granlund.
We knew Granlund was a good player, and this year he has struggled big time. Granlund's been a healthy scratch for the Minnesota Wild this year. He hasn't put up the numbers that they were expecting him. He's been given top 6 minutes, and he ties for second overall in scoring in the Olympics. He makes the All-Olympic team on forward, and he was absolutely awesome. Finland's best player, and for me, big winner. Ryan Suter, again, was
Hang on, let me interrupt you for a second. Do you think this propels Granlund to having a better remainder of the season for the Wild?
It can't hurt. And again, you look at what an Olympics is going to do. And this question has come up a lot, Richie, with Blake Wheeler. Blake Wheeler was picked to Team USA and didn't play a lot. Yeah. And a lot of questions have come up. Well, he was playing well for the Jets before that. Is this going to affect him? I tend to believe it won't. And I don't think a guy like that, who's a professional, who's been in the NHL for many years, is going to have a serious confidence issue after that. We know that players have to accept certain roles. Same thing goes for Martin St. Louis. Same thing goes for P.K. Subban. I don't think all of a sudden P.K. Subban is going to be a lesser player. Now, as far as Michael Granlund goes, yeah, I do think it is going to help him. He wasn't scoring, and for the Minnesota Wild, they don't score a lot of goals. Mikko Koivu's injured. I do think it'll help. Ryan Suter, a guy that, for the Team USA, played half of the game, even though we knew his minutes would be slightly decreased, but he was unbelievable with Ryan McDonagh. Another team like the Jets that's in a fight for that last playoff spot in the Western Conference, I thought Ryan Suter was excellent and really was the as we expected, the rock of that defense. So I think for a team like the Minnesota Wild, who really don't score a lot of goals and are decimated by injuries right now, Mikko Koivu being the main one, I thought those two guys were big winners in the Olympics.
I don't know if there are many other winners. How many guys stood out to you this tournament?
I thought Olli Jokinen had a nice tournament, but
yeah, but Olli Jokinen just played the way he always plays and ended up putting up some points. But did anybody really take over in terms of next? Like, you know, as he mentions Granlund, I think that's a good observation. Are there many other guys you thought, okay, wow, this guy really stood out for me?
Then let's flip the question: how many losers are in this tournament?
Well, again, I mean,
you got to mention Teemu is a winner too.
Yeah, of course, Teemu's a winner, and then that's in that he's always been that productive guy. I mean, aside from that one
season. Yeah, this isn't like his breakout party, and he wasn't dominant. He was just very good.
Very good, and professional in the way he handled himself. In terms of losers, Drew, I mean, do you look at a guy who's won before, but a guy like Dustin Brown, who doesn't play a lot in the last game and a half for U.S. and then kind of takes issue with it in the media? Is that something, you know, is there a professionalism there that ought to have been demonstrated that wasn't? You could point that out. In terms of Sweden, Daniel Sedin, invisible. And I know he's been invisible basically for the whole year anyways. But I know Henrik's not playing. And I know he came back on that back check and dive and stopped that 2-on-1 there near the second period of the Canada-Sweden game. But none of those guys were worrying me.
Yeah.
And when they faced top end, when the other teams faced the U.S. and Sweden faced top end defensive play, not only the six defensemen, but also the back checking forwards, did any of those big guys do anything? I mean, in the U.S. Canada game, you say Kessel created a bit, Parise created some opportunities. Is anybody else really? And then Sweden, did anybody really do anything for you? You're best on best. If you're that good, if you just got an extension to Vancouver for, you know, $6+ million, might want to put up some points against the best players in the world.
What about a guy like Dan Bylsma? You're not enamored with Bylsma as a head coach, Richard, but
let me put it this way.
Okay.
He has his shortcomings.
Mm-hmm.
I think he's being unfairly criticized based on the U.S.'s performance. The U.S.
You know, you wonder why they lose, and you hear the rumblings out of the room. Maybe the rumblings say more about that team than the what. Maybe the people rumbling and the fact there are rumblings say more about that team than what the rumbling, what the people who are saying those things actually are saying.
Meaning, it says more about the players than it does the coach.
Yeah, long and short, but that's exactly what I'm saying. Because if you look at Dustin Brown, you look at some other guys, they throw Bylsma under the bus, basically, or they question the strategies and all that. Hey, I'm pretty sure the strategy is when you have the puck, you're supposed to score in the offensive zone. I mean, take away the strategies for the second. Take away the systems. What are you supposed to do? Parise, who I love, what are you supposed to do when you drag that puck? You're supposed to put a top corner, not stomach, on Price. What are you supposed to do? Pacioretty, all those guys. What are you supposed to do? Defense. That didn't really... there's a lot of things there that I didn't like what was coming out of that room. So, you know, if Bylsma doesn't like line matching, but there's a lot of strong parts about Bylsma's coaching system. It's amazing how this tournament, though, can change the perception of for NHL players of coaches.
Yeah, to me, that's a lot of sour grapes. Sure, maybe Dan Bylsma isn't at the same level as Mike Babcock, but he's had some success in the NHL. But, you know, quickly here with losers, we talked a lot about them on Saturday. With Russia, you got to mention Ovechkin and Malkin. This was their big opportunity to really win the gold medal and really be two dominant players, best on best. And Ovechkin didn't have any points in the last four games and was extremely disappointing. And yes, he was dealing with, you know, the issue with his father and all that, but that was a little bit after. And
he didn't know about it till after the tournament.
He didn't know about
it
till after. So to me, those guys are losers. If we're picking losers, because those guys didn't even get their team into the semis. And a lot was riding on their shoulders, and they didn't get it done. Malkin won goal.
Malkin was brutal.
Let's go to break. When we come back, Corey Massasak from NHL.com is going to join us. You're listening to NHL Midweek. We're live on TSN 1290.
You're listening to
The Illegal Curve Hockey Show.
The podcast
on TSN1290.ca.
25 minutes before the top of the hour. Welcome back to NHL Midweek. You can follow us on Twitter at Illegal Curve, Facebook.com/Illegal Curve, and our website with the latest Winnipeg Jets and NHL news is IllegalCurve.com.
The NHL Midweek Hockey Hotline.
Transferring a call.
We're pleased to welcome back to NHL Midweek from NHL.com, Corey Massasak. Corey, good evening. Thanks very much for joining us. And is it good to be back on North American soil?
Yeah, it's been, you know, I've spent a lot of time the past couple of days catching up on some sleep. And my eating habits aren't quite all back in North America. But, it was a great couple of weeks over there, but it's definitely good to be back.
Corey, we brought you on to do an analysis of the tournament, a post-event analysis. The first question we had, you know, are you surprised at how quickly the tournament narrative changed over the final two or three days of the tournament?
Yeah, a little bit. I mean, scoring was down the whole time. I mean, it was basically, you know, the Americans were scoring goals left and right, and everybody else couldn't score. And then all of a sudden, once they ran into a couple of teams that, you know, played better defense than the ones that they had already played, it, you know, nobody could score. So, I mean, essentially, Mike Babcock kept telling everybody, you know, that his team was fine and that things were going to be fine, and sure enough, they ended up being more than fine. I mean, it was ended up being, you know, by the end of it, people were talking about it being one of the most dominant performances by a team in the Olympics ever. So.
Corey, the Nicholas Backstrom story, you know, kind of breaks right before the game that he's not going to play in the gold medal game, and about allergy medication that he was taking. Is there any more to that story that we need to know about?
I don't. You know what? That was honestly one of the maybe the craziest post game press conference I've ever been to. I mean, it was like a half hour long, and it was almost surreal. It was like the general manager of Sweden and the Swedish doctor, basically, at times they were kind of grilling the IIHF guy, who was also kept claiming that Backstrom was an innocent victim, and it was basically just three guys railing on the IOC and the decision that they had made. And so, I mean, they said that there had been the proper notification or paperwork filled out that the IOC was supposed to know that Backstrom was taking that medication ahead of time. And he's taken tests before and never had a problem. So there was never really an exact response to, well, why did he fail this test this time? Like I even actually asked the question, well, if he's taken this stuff regularly, why would he have a positive test this one time?
Right.
And the answer was, well, it was just bad timing. Like, they made it sound like if he had taken the medication a little bit earlier or a little bit later, it would have, the reading would have been different. So, I mean, there was never really, there was a lot of accusations that, like, trying to get to the heart, the facts of what exactly happened, other than, you know, that you know, he's been taking this medication for years and he's never had a problem, and the, you know, they all felt that the IOC basically you know, made the wrong decision to suspend him for this game.
Corey, do you make anything of the Team USA performance in the bronze medal game, or was that just a team that was emotionally spent from the Canadian semifinal game?
Yeah, I mean, I think they played really well in the first period and didn't score, which, I mean, a lot of teams had game, you know, had like periods where they played well and didn't score. That was kind of the first time that they did that. And then they gave up those two quick goals, and I think, I mean, I don't want to say it's human nature, but they, Dan Bylsma called timeout and, you know, kind of implored them to play better, and they didn't. And mm-hmm. So, I mean, I certainly don't think, it seemed like there was a lot of criticism of him for that game. I think it's almost certainly on the players for that game. And I think on the flip side, though, I mean, that Finnish team, they were such underdogs throughout the whole tournament. I just feel like somebody probably stood up in that locker room before the game and pointed at Timo Solani and said, we're winning a bronze medal for that guy today. And that's the way that they played.
You're listening to NHL Midweek on TSN 1290, online at tsn1290.ca. We're talking about the Olympic hockey tournament with Corey Mastisak from NHL.com. Corey, it's, you know, it's always good to go out on top, and Steve Yzerman is certainly going out on top. Twice he was Team Canada's general manager. Twice he won gold medals. He announced immediately at the end of the tournament that he's not going to do the job in 2018. Who do you expect will get that job for Team Canada come 2018, especially if there's NHL players in South Korea?
Oh, boy, that's a good question. I actually hadn't really thought about it yet. You know what? I mean, he was kind of an interesting case, right, because he hadn't actually taken the Lightning job mm-hmm. as the general manager yet. So, I mean, it could be somebody, I could see them going in that similar direction where they don't want somebody who has been a general manager in the NHL with a specific team for a long time. I don't know. I mean, it's probably, I would assume it's going to be somebody who has, you know, kind of a long history with Hockey Canada. So maybe a guy like Joe Sakic. I mean, I know mm-hmm. He has a kind of that team president role with the Avalanche, but he has a long history with Hockey Canada, and I don't know. I mean, I'm completely speculating at that point, but I mean, that seems like a name. Like Steve Yzerman is a name, right? Like, I mean, that was kind of part of the deal with making him the GM in 2010.
Yeah, Corey, we're watching right now live. Carey Price is getting a long standing ovation here in Montreal with the gold medal around his neck on TSN right now. Corey, when you look at the tournament as a whole, though, as a hockey fan from the outside, is there some concern that the Czech Republic, Slovakia, Russia, all of these teams appear to be worse than they were 10 years ago?
A little bit, I think. I think specifically the Czech Republic and Slovakia, their programs are kind of, you know, they've definitely been trending downward. At the same time, like Sweden, Sweden, the United States, and you could probably throw in Switzerland or seem to be trending way up. I think, I mean, there's always been kind of this notion that there's the big seven, but then some people will say that there's never really been a big seven, that, you know, it's really only a big three or a big four. But, I mean, I think, if anything, you look at this tournament, and maybe one of the big themes, at least early on, was that the gap between the top two or three and the rest might still be pretty big, but the gap between, like, the Czech Republic, Slovakia, and, like, Latvia and Norway and those countries is not as big. I mean, I think there are more countries that can be competitive than there used to be. It's just, you know, are there the same number of countries that can still win a gold medal?
Corey, we talked about this on the show last week. Richie actually brought up the idea of changing the format for the Olympics from the current format that exists, the round-robin format, where everyone essentially has a chance, regardless of the record, making the games more important. Have you heard of any talk of changing the format to make the round robin essentially more meaningful?
No, I don't think so. Well, I think part of it, part of the reason why they've gone to this format the last two Olympics is they had the format that they had in 2006. I think the NHL felt that the players had too many games, and so, I mean, the way the format changed, you know, basically so they could play less games. Yeah, I mean, that was, I think some people talked about it during the tournament. Like, you had a game, like, where Slovakia lost this game to Slovenia and, like, just came, I mean, that shouldn't, it was such a shock that it happened, but at the same time, you know, they basically could have, I mean, you could have lost all three of your, you know, your pool games and still won the gold medal. So, I mean, it would be interesting if they, maybe if they, I don't know if you would just consider, like, basically not having the bottom four advance and just go straight to the quarterfinals. But I mean, I think in the current format, that's probably about the only way you could do that.
Yeah, of course, there's been a lot made about the injuries that have occurred, that did occur during the Olympics, and I haven't seen the stats, but I'm wondering if maybe the break for the other players in the league ends up results in less injuries for maybe the rest of the National Hockey League. But in any event, do you think the injuries will be a factor in the determination of going to South Korea in 2018?
I don't think there'll be as much of a factor as it seems like, you know, people are writing about right now, to be honest. I mean, I think if you had played 2 weeks of NHL games, there would have been injuries. If there ends up being a World Cup at some point, which it certainly seems to be heading in that direction, there's going to be injuries during that. I mean, I think somebody might, you know, there might be somebody who wasn't on an Olympic team who gets hurt over the next couple of days. I mean, I don't think, it seems like it's like a, I don't want to call it a knee-jerk reaction, but it's an immediate thing that somebody can grab onto. But in terms of the overall, like, big picture, I don't think that's going to be, like, the biggest reason that they do go or don't go in 4 years.
Corey, we'll let you go on this last question, and it's a follow-up to the previous one. Do you think the NHL ends up going to South Korea in 2018?
I hope so. I mean, I really, I loved the whole just being there for the 2 weeks. And it seems like, I know there's been criticism from a few different, like, members of teams, but everybody that was there wasn't a single, you know, outside of maybe Matt, I think Matt Duchene complained about the ice when Canada wasn't scoring enough, but, like, I mean, Ken Holland and Steve Yzerman made a pretty passionate plea about, you know, to go on for you. So, I think there's a lot of stuff that goes on behind the scenes with the IOC and the IIHF, but, I can't, just from my, this was the first one that I've ever gone to, and it was such a different thing than any other thing in hockey that I've ever covered. So, like, the players seem almost unanimous about wanting to go, and there's just there's more, you know, like, the whole idea of having TJ Oshie on the Today Show is something that you don't get from anywhere else in hockey. So I hope so.
Corey Mastisak covers the NHL for NHL.com. Thanks very much, Corey, for joining us this evening, on NHL Midweek with the Illegal Curve Hockey Show.
Yeah, thanks for having me. Anytime.
Take care, Corey. Let's go to break. You're listening to TSN 1290, tsn1290.ca.
You're listening to
the Illegal Curve Hockey Show,
the podcast
on tsn1290.ca.
10 minutes before the top of the hour here on NHL Midweek. Big thank you to Corey Mastisak from NHL.com. In case you missed any of that interview, it will be available for download on iTunes and on tsn1290.ca. This coming Sunday night, the Jets play Saturday afternoon in Nashville. This coming Sunday night is the biggest entertainment event of the year. That, of course, is the Oscars, live on CTV at 8:30 p.m. Eastern Time, 7:30 p.m. here in Winnipeg. Normally, you have to be in front of your TV to catch the Oscars. Not this year. Using the CTV Go unlock, the CTV Go app, which will be unlocked and available for everyone to use, you can catch the Oscars wherever you may be on Sunday night, streaming on your smartphone. Just download the CTV Go app. Doesn't matter what service you're on, doesn't matter what provider you're on, you can catch the Oscars wherever you may be this coming Sunday on CTV, 7:30 p.m. start time on locally here in Winnipeg on CTV and on the CTV Go app.
I guess the big question becomes, who is Drew wearing?
Drew will be wearing his finest sweatpants,
Drew will for sure be wearing, like, Drew will be wearing corned beef.
I'm not going to wrap myself in corned beef. That would be very...
I will be wearing Zubaz.
Yeah.
And a Winnipeg Jets backwards fitted cap.
No shirt.
I'll be wearing Speed Stick Menon.
We hope.
And I'm really excited.
I think we'll stop at that point. Let's get to six things.
Remus is for sure in an Oscars pool, I can tell you right now. Remus, you in an Oscar? Oh, yeah, I can see your mom. Remus's mom is a big movie buff.
Really?
Yeah.
They call Remus the Wolf of Osborne.
Six things we learned this week.
Commence countdown. Six.
Ezzy, we'll start with you. Six things we learned from the Olympic hockey tournament. And number one for you, Ezzy, after watching some of the best players the KHL has to offer competing in the Olympics, it's clear that the National Hockey League has no close rival when it comes to talent.
Well, we talked about this a little bit on Saturday. Some of the Russian players, mainly it was two teams that really brought KHL players. There were obviously players from the Swedish Elite League and the Finnish Elite League, the Swiss League. But for the most part, it was a big statement that before this tournament, Alexei Kazatonov picked 40% of the team coming from the KHL. And even though Alexander Radulov had, you know, glimpses and Ilya Kovalchuk had glimpses.
Kovalchuk is terrible.
This big... You know, yeah, I guess the shootout I'm talking about, he was pretty impressive. But when you talk about some of these other guys from the Russian league, whether it's Alexander Svitov or some of the other Medvedev, some of these other guys, sure, they were some good players, and the Finns had eight KHL players. But the whole talk about the KHL and Russia's making a statement to show how good this league is and
junk.
All this... I don't think the KHL is even close to the quality of hockey that you see in the NHL, and I know that Jokerit is joining the KHL next year, and that will increase the talent level in this tournament. But when you talk about the KHL and how this was supposed to be a coming-out party and we were going to see some of these players and how good they were, I just don't think it happened, and I think the Russia's performance showed that.
Five.
Richard Pollock, sticking with Russian players, Andrei Markov lowered his value with by the way he performed during the Olympic tournament.
Markov's a good player. Drew moves the puck really well. He doesn't skate especially well. I thought that was very apparent in the tournament. And, you know, playing alongside Subban amongst other guys in Montreal, he's a good player, but he's not what he once was. And I don't doesn't mean he doesn't have value. And I know Montreal like to get him signed to a deal here. But I think when the whole league gets to watch Markov play, they get to see a little bit of the drawbacks in acquiring a guy like that, and I wonder if, you know, he does hit the open market, if he gets the money that he thinks that he'd be asking for.
I don't know where I heard this. It must have been on TSN that Montreal offered him a 1-year extension worth $6 million, yeah. And he wants multi years.
He wants like 3 years. Was what I read as well, and I'm wondering, you know, if he's offered 3 years, will it be for 12 or 13 and a half kind of thing, and not, you know, 15, 18 that he might want.
Four.
Ezzy, on the international ice surface, Matt Duchene proved that he might be the best natural skater in the world.
And we already knew that. And one of the reasons why he was picked on for this team above certain other players was because of his skating ability. And he only got into four games and didn't have any points and didn't play much. I think he was averaging about 10 minutes a game for Team Canada. But to watch Matt Duchene go from 0 to 60 is truly incredible. And there were a lot of fast players on Team Canada, and there were a lot of fast players in this tournament. But I think we saw on the international ice really how good Matt Duchene can skate. And if you've watched the Colorado Avalanche play this year, and they've been to the MTS Center this year, we know that he's an excellent player. He's a top, legitimate top forward in the NHL. But to watch him on the international ice almost make it look easy. And to go from that, he finds that next level so easily. And not only that, I think his quality of skating is another thing. He gets to the right spots, and even though he didn't get any goals, I think he showed how good his skating ability is against top players in the world.
Three.
Richard Pollock, the system that certain teams employ expose some players for what they really are and show the true value in other players.
It's always interesting to see how a player performs when he's not in familiar surroundings. So you look at a guy like Drew Doughty, who's restricted by the style of play and the systems in place in Los Angeles, and he was an absolutely dominant force. If you watch Drew Doughty on a night-to-night basis, you'll know that. But to a different level because he was able to carry the puck up continually. I thought that was apparent. I thought Voinov, his Slava Voinov, his teammate, on the other hand, looked a little bit more human than maybe he has in the past, especially last year and previous years in their cup runs. I thought that was interesting. You know, looking at St. Louis Blues players, a guy like Jay Bomeister, I thought he had a great tournament. Not that he's not going to look good in St. Louis, but in a different way, the way he was pinching in and moving the puck. And you look at, you know, guys like Patrick Berglund, and when they're playing in Ken Hitchcock's system, do they look better in the NHL than they do when they have a little more pressure and they're a little more open, or there's more skating room, or they're expected to do different things? I thought all of those things were very interesting. And if you look at players sometimes, you don't like, look at Jeff Carter, another King example. You know anything about Jeff Carter? Like, do you ever see him play? Do you ever see him move? Like, when you see him, he plays that way in LA sometimes, but he took it to a different level, I thought. He had the ability to try different things. And I know they play a defensive style, but I just thought the systems that the teams play is a big factor in the way they look on a night-to-night basis. And this is a nice change to see how they look in different situations.
Two.
Ezzy, you think it's time to allow body-to-body contact in women's hockey?
Absolutely. I'm sitting watching the game on Thursday morning, the gold medal game, of course, and Canada wins. And I'm talking to a big group of people, men and women, different levels of hockey fans, and everyone is in agreement. And I think it's time. I think it's absolutely ridiculous that women are not allowed to hit. And the argument has been that if you allow hitting, especially in international play, then the Canadians and Americans have even more of an advantage over other countries. But it's absolutely ridiculous. Women are equal to men. In fact, I think women are better than men, to be honest with you. But I think it's absolutely ridiculous. Let these women hit. It's hockey. Body checking is a huge part of hockey. It's ridiculous, in my opinion, that some of these women are penalized for hitting. So I think it's time. And I think, why not do it after arguably the greatest game ever played in women's hockey?
Mm-hmm. One.
Richard Pollock, after his performance as a Team Canada assistant coach, Ralph Kruger proved that he got short shrift from the Edmonton Oilers.
Yeah, I think he did get short shrift, Drew. I think when you have the masterminds of Ralph Kruger on international ice and Ken Hitchcock, and you know, who's great on NHL ice and on Olympic ice, you had two guys sitting up above who could break down the game better than many other people. And I thought that was an advantage for Team Canada going in, Hitchcock and Kruger, and those guys breaking it down and being able to change it up in game, see what systems the other teams are employing, see what style of play they're using, and then combat it. And I thought Kruger, who did an amazing interview, I thought, on this show, talking about how to defend and how to play on the international ice, his inclusion in this brain trust was invaluable. And if you read a little more about it, Mike Babcock actually said, "I don't know a lot about international game. I have struggled when I've been out there," although he did win a world championship, I believe, "but he didn't feel comfortable." And he said, "Let's bring somebody on with more experience." And they did, and look at the results.
Right, and for those who don't know, Babcock came from the WHL before the NHL. And Richie makes a good point, and Kruger on the show was very good. Thinks the game just as good as anybody, and you're right, he was a good asset for Team Canada.
We have put a bow on the Olympic hockey tournament. We now shift our focus back to the Winnipeg Jets and the remaining 22 games that they play in this NHL season. They start tomorrow night against the Phoenix Coyotes at MTS Center, a game you can hear live on TSN 1290. And when we come back, Phoenix Coyotes color analyst Tyson Nash is going to join us. You're listening to NHL Midweek. We're live on TSN 1290.
You're listening to
The Illegal Curve Hockey Show.
The podcast
on TSN1290.ca.
One hour down, 1 hour to go. Welcome back to NHL Midweek with The Illegal Curve Hockey Show here on TSN1290. You can follow us on Twitter at Illegal Curve, Facebook.com/Illegal Curve, and our website with the latest Winnipeg Jets and NHL news is IllegalCurve.com.
Now, let's go live on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show Hotline.
Pleased to welcome back to NHL Midweek the Phoenix Coyotes color analyst Tyson Nash. Tyson, good evening. Thanks very much for joining us, and we apologize for the weather.
Well, I'll tell you what, it's a little bit of a difference. It's a 100-degree difference between when we took off today and in Phoenix and when we landed here in Winnipeg, but it's hockey weather. The holidays are over, and it's back to the business.
Tyson, more importantly, did you get a table at Earl's Main?
I did. We're throwing around a few smiles here. We're taking in all Winnipeg has to offer, and we are not disappointed, Blake.
No surprise there whatsoever. Tyson, obviously we wanted to start with the upcoming NHL trade deadline, which is a week from today, next Wednesday. And, you know, earlier this week, Coyotes general manager Don Maloney came out and he said that, you know, he didn't expect to be busy because the team is right up against their internal budget. They're right up against their internal salary cap, if not the NHL's salary cap. You know, how much do you think that's going to limit Don Maloney and the maneuvers he may have wanted to make ahead of this trade deadline?
Well, I think, you know, Don Maloney and every GM in the NHL, you know, I think it's all the same. You don't want to, you know, to wreck your entire future for right now. You know, the one team wins the Stanley Cup, you know, obviously you want to, if the right deal comes along and, you know, they're not asking for too much in return, well, then it's a no-brainer. And money for money type deals. I mean, there's so much that goes into making a move. Chemistry in the locker room. You know, the list goes on. So it's always an interesting time, the trade deadline. You see teams that, you know, sell the farm to get that one or two, you know, extra player to try and put them over the top, and all of a sudden they're out in the first round. You know, you definitely don't want to be in that situation. Don Maloney has always been very cautious about the moves that he's made. And he's made some real good ones. I'm sure they would love to add some talent up front. I think this team is caught in the middle of, you know, are they trying to be more of a skill team, or are they still that grinded out, you know, type of mucking team? So I think, you know, first of all, you got to figure out what your identity is moving forward. But they're still looking for that, probably that first line, second line, left winger to play with Martin Hansel and Radim Gurbanov. They just have not found that player yet.
Tyson, I mean, most people in the National Hockey League have taken notice of the emergence of Oliver Ekman-Larsson, how dominant a player he is, great skater, smart player, can do everything. What do you make of the complete debacle of the ice time that he received while playing for Sweden in the Olympics?
Well, I didn't watch all that closely the first couple games. My understanding, he made a couple turnovers early in the tournament, and I think that was it for Oliver Ekman-Larsson. I think it's just crazy watching this kid, you know, game in and game out, how he plays against the top players in the National Hockey League, the ice time that he eats up. He's one of the best skating defensemen in the NHL, but yet, you know, he can't play in the Olympics. I have to scratch my head at that. I mean, everyone, you know, a little bit jittery early in the tournament. You know, I think that what Oliver brings, I think Team Sweden, although they did get the silver medal, I think they definitely missed out with what Oliver Ekman-Larsson can bring, especially, you know, in the early part of that game when you're down by a goal or two. He's the guy that you want out there to control your blue line, control your power play, and make things happen. He has that ability. He is a game changer. So I think, you know, that was a real bad coaching decision from my view.
Tyson, when you were playing in the NHL, you went through several Olympic breaks. We were talking about it on the show earlier. What type of impact does the Olympic break have? Do you believe that a good Olympic tournament will translate into the regular season? What kind of impact, really, in your experience, what did the Olympics have on a team?
Well, I think it always hurt teams that were on a roll going into the Olympic break. You know, I think you lose that rhythm, and you fight to get it back, and that's the big worry for a team that is rolling going into the break. All of a sudden, you have whatever it was, 18 days off, and you try to regain where your team left off. For a team that's struggling, or a player that's struggling, the break couldn't come at a better time just to regroup, re-energize, and basically start from scratch. So, you know, I think a lot of the teams and the players, it was always fun because now you're looking at it going, okay, we got 24 games. The season is really technically almost over. Mm-hmm. That sounds crazy because it's still 24 more games for the Coyotes. But as a player, you're like, I can go absolutely all out for these next 24 games, whether you're in a contract situation. And more importantly, you know, if your team is on the outside looking in, you're hanging around that playoff picture, you can really put the pedal to the metal, and it is an all-out sprint to the last game of the regular season. So it's going to be fun.
You're listening to NHL Midweek on TSN 1290. We're joined by Tyson Nash. Tyson Nash. He's the Phoenix Coyotes color analyst. Tyson, you mentioned the, you know, the playoff push, and you know the Coyotes have 24 games left. They're right in the dogfight for that final Western Conference playoff spot, the second wild card spot, with the Winnipeg Jets, the Vancouver Canucks, the Dallas Stars, and the Nashville Predators. You know, in your mind, what is the key for the Coyotes to get that final playoff spot over the other teams I just mentioned?
Well, consistency is number one. This is a team that has just struggled all year long to put it together on a game-to-game basis. And usually when that happens, you find yourself on the out looking in. And that's why the Coyotes are sitting in that spot. They can dominate a team like the Pittsburgh Penguins and the Chicago Blackhawks and the LA Kings, but yet they cannot win against the Buffalo Sabres, the Calgary Flames. I mean, they have absolutely just blown points, flushed them down the toilet, and you hope that doesn't come back to bite them. But this is a team that relies on their goaltending. You look at this week in practice, and if Dave Tippett has basically hit the reset button, it's been a little bit of a mini training camp again, and this team is all about defense. How they play in their own zone is going to dictate, you know, whether this team makes it or they don't make it. And again, it's all about consistency.
And Tyson, we're based in Winnipeg, you know, and you mentioned that teams playing well before the break sometimes had issues, and Winnipeg was 6-3-1 heading into the break, and Dallas, who everybody's chasing, I guess, was 6-2-2. Who do you see as Phoenix's biggest threat for that final playoff spot?
Well, I think all of them. You look at Winnipeg now, they were dead and gone, and now all of a sudden they're 2 points back of the Coyotes and the Dallas Stars. So you can't really count anyone out. I mean, you know, Winnipeg's a good example of what I was talking about. How can they play that good, you know, under Paul Maurice? And, you know, where's the consistency? Where has that been all year? You know, and if it was there all year, where they would be right now? And the Coyotes are much similar. The good thing is for Winnipeg is they're right there in the picture. They can see the finish line now with, I don't know how many games they have left, but it's going to be a battle. Dallas, you know, this is a team that relies on their goaltender. They have, you know, high-powered offense. I think their defense is probably their biggest issue there. Minnesota is also a team that you wonder if they can keep things rolling there in Minnesota for the Wild. So it's going to be interesting to see who falls out of it, but somebody definitely will.
I don't have it offhand, Tyson, but I'm assuming during the course of your career you were part of a coaching change, if not a few. And when that happens and there is a turnaround like the Jets have had, at least in the short term, what do you attribute that to? Is that almost always more of a motivational thing than a systematic thing?
Well, I think for the short term, yeah, definitely it's motivational, but that wears off, and that wears off real fast. So I think what Paul Maurice has brought to this Winnipeg Jets team is a system. You know, something that every player and the team can take pride in. And that's all players want. Players just want a job. They want something to take pride in. They want to know that, no, I don't have to go out and score goals like a Little or a Ladd if you're a third or a fourth line guy. But you know that if you go out and do your job and don't get a point or don't get on the score sheet, that you're going to get rewarded at the end of the year and that your coach, Paul Maurice, will appreciate what you bring. And that, as a player, is everything in my mind. You don't want to be second-guessing yourself, second-guessing what the coach may be thinking. And I think, you know, from my understanding, I was in Toronto, not part of the Leafs, but part of the Marlies when Paul Maurice was there. And I just said he was a very good communicator, along with Dave Tippett, who was here in Phoenix. And there is not a player walking around that locker room not knowing where they stand and where they fit on this team. And I think that's very important. I think that's been the biggest reason for this change in Winnipeg.
Tyson, the trade deadline's a week away. How active do you expect Don Maloney and his staff to be before the trade deadline?
Well, if you look at his track record in years past, probably fairly active. He always seems to add a couple pieces to the puzzle. You know, he's pulled the Jedi mind trick on a few GMs over the years. So we're sure hoping here in Phoenix that is going to be the case again this year. You know, with all these teams, the parity around the league, everybody thinks that they have a chance to get in the playoff picture. So it's very difficult for any team, really, besides maybe an Edmonton or a Calgary or a Buffalo or teams that are completely right out of it, to make moves because they all think that they might have a shot.
Tyson, we'll let you get back to your dinner and your, visual appeal. But anyways, we appreciate you giving your time, and thanks very much for joining us this afternoon on NHL Midweek with the Illegal Curve Hockey Show.
All right, thanks, guys. And make sure you tell these people we're not pieces of meat here, all right? we're human beings.
You bet. We'll let them know that. Thanks very much, Tyson. Tyson Nash, Phoenix Coyotes color analyst. You're listening to NHL Midweek. Let's go to break. When we come back, we'll look at the Winnipeg Jets' remaining schedule before the playoffs.
You're listening to
The Illegal Curve Hockey Show,
the podcast
on TSN1290.ca.
Big thank you to Tyson Nash, Phoenix Coyotes color analyst, for joining us in the previous segment. In case you missed it, it will be available for download on iTunes now that the Olympics are over. We'll be back posting all shows on iTunes, on TSN1290.ca, and of course on our website, illegalcurve.com. The Winnipeg Jets get back on the ice tomorrow against those Phoenix Coyotes. It is a 7 p.m. puck drop at MTS Center, game you can hear live on TSN 1290. And we're really right now, I mean, you know, this break, and now it's 22 games for the Winnipeg Jets, and you're right, this is the playoff push. This is it. I mean, there's no more time there. You know, if you don't go hard over these next 22 games, this is it. You're done. You know, you got to win these next 22 games, and you got to win a fair number of them to make it into the playoffs in the Western Conference. You look at the Western Conference playoff race currently, the Jets are 2 points behind the Dallas Stars, who hold down that final wild card spot. The first wild card spot is held by the Minnesota Wild. They have a 5-point lead. To me, the Minnesota Wild are pretty cement. They're pretty secure in that spot right now.
I agree with that.
Yeah, I mean, they've been playing very well. They've been playing well before the break. 6-2-2. They've been a pretty good Western Conference team.
Well, they've been streaky, but yeah, they've been good.
Yeah, before that,
I mean, there's a lull there. They almost got Mike Gill fired, but yeah, they're, you know, I mean, 5-point lead, Drew. With only Phoenix having one game in hand and Vancouver and Winnipeg giving up a game to them, that's tough.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. So Dallas is the team I think the Jets really have to be focusing on. The Stars, 2 points ahead of the Jets, but two games in hand. And, you know, that's the key for the Jets is right now that's where they have to hope that the teams that are ahead of them and the teams that have games in hand on them don't capitalize on it. Because if they do, let's say the Dallas Stars win both of those games, all of a sudden your deficit is really 6 points. And that's a lot harder to come catch up in this day and age in the NHL than a 2-point deficit as things currently stand.
It's also the 4-point games. Like tomorrow's game is a 4-point game.
That's right.
When you're playing against Phoenix and Phoenix is 2 points ahead of you with two games in hand, it's almost a must win.
Yeah, it is. I mean, it's hard to believe. Yeah. I mean, because you expect that there's going to be this lull because all the teams have been off for the 2 weeks. But you know, if you look at all the teams in the NHL, I think this break is going to help the Winnipeg Jets most out of some of the teams.
See, I don't know about that because, you know, you look at Phoenix, sure, Smith goes over, Korpikoski goes over, and Hanzel and Ekman-Larsson. There's some drama there, the fact that Ekman-Larsson doesn't play and Smith went over, had a good experience, but didn't play. All that, but the Jets were rolling before this. And the question is there momentum? Is that time off going to have any effect at all on them? Do they play any better? Likely not. The question is, does this make them play worse?
I agree with you on the momentum argument, because obviously the way they've been playing and they've been competitive in pretty much every game, and I mean they finished the break against that hard-fought shootout loss against the St. Louis Blues, one of the upper echelon teams in the NHL. The reason why I think it's going to help them is a guy like Jacob Trouba, who the Jets have relied upon so much this year, and who's been so good on the back end, has never played this many games in a hockey season. You know, he played at University of Michigan, where he would have played how many games? 30 games?
35, yeah.
35 games. So instead, he gets a 2-week break that I think will do a lot to sort of recharge his batteries and keep him playing well into the real latter parts of the season. Same with Dustin Byfuglien. Dustin Byfuglien's a guy who usually does wear down, you know, towards the end of the year, because, you know, he's not in the best of shape, and we all documented all those reasons ad nauseum. He gets a 2-week break that I think will help him recharge his batteries a little bit more.
These are
key components for the Winnipeg Jets.
Yeah, absolutely, Drew. There's something to be said for the break and players that are dealing with injuries that can now use that time that they wouldn't have to heal those injuries. And it goes back to what Tyson Nash just said before coming on with us. it's that momentum, and it has the ability to be a momentum killer. And I think it's really difficult to say that one team has an advantage or a disadvantage mm-hmm. coming out of the Olympic break, because everybody's dealing with the same advantages and disadvantages and the same type of rust that we're going to see. If you watched the Buffalo-Carolina game yesterday, it was an absolutely boring hockey game.
Did you watch that game?
I watch hockey every day. Come on, what are you talking about?
Ted Nolan looked down the bench and was asking for the Latvian squad.
Oh, God, I mean, I don't go a day without watching
Buffalo, Carolina. Oh my God!
Come on, Drew. Yeah, that's a game that's the game you got to watch.
Oh, Buffalo stole that game. Carolina outshot
the problem. Is you're out there watching every game. I'm trying to watch as many as I can. Drew's watching. What were you watching? Dancing with the Stars last night, Drew?
No, I don't think that was on last night. I don't remember what I watched.
The Voice was it? The Voice?
It was a big Bachelor night last night.
I honestly don't know what I watched last night.
Well, it wasn't very.
Paid me enough to watch Buffalo play Carolina.
Why not? I mean, Eric Staal ready to roll, prove they should be on the Olympic team.
That was Cam Ward's first game since New Year's
Eve.
Yeah. Okay, well,
you're not
Ryan Miller
me
playing his way out of town.
My point being, there's going to be rust. There's always going to be rust after a 2.5 week break. For the Jets, they have an opportunity here. They've got 22 games left, 9 of 12 right off the bat, Richie, are at home. So the schedule maker is in their favor. They have an opportunity to take advantage of that, with Phoenix.
Of the 22 games the Jets have, 12 are at home, 10 are on the road.
Yeah, the tough games are later on. I mean, now they got to make hay right now.
You have a hard road trip there, Richie, in California. You go to California and you go to Phoenix, 5 straight games on the road. You want to put yourself in a situation you'd have to hope that they can go 9-3, at least 8-4. If you don't go 8-4, if you go 7-5 or something closely resembling 500 hockey, it's not going to cut it. Because as we talked about, when Paul Maurice took over, there's 35 games left. And we knew, roughly 35, I think it was, maybe 36. We said they'd probably have to go somewhere around 24-12.
I crunched the numbers. Of the Jets, the Predators, the Coyotes, the Canucks, and the Dallas Stars, the Jets have the hardest schedule remaining.
They do have a hard schedule,
Their opponent's winning percentage is .529. That's the highest of the five teams. The Dallas Stars have the easiest of the schedules. The Jets have the hardest. And, I mean, you look at that road trip the Jets have at the end of March. That's the killer road trip. The trip through where it starts in Dallas, goes to California, and then it finishes in Phoenix. That's the five-game road trip.
And we might never hear about it if they don't play well up to it, and we might hear a lot about it if they are playing well, and they have to really go into that one and see what they can, you know, and again, well, return to California, I'd say, and actually, you know, try and beat Anaheim again and see if they can try and sneak one out of San Jose. They almost did last time. I want to focus more on who their competition is here. And you're looking at Dallas, Vancouver, Nashville, and Phoenix. And Dallas is in the driver's seat in terms of they're the one ranked, the second wild card team right now on a tiebreaker with Phoenix. They've had the same amount of games and the same amount of points. I think Dallas was playing great hockey before the break. And while they had the same record as Minnesota in the last 10 and 1 point better than Winnipeg, I thought they were playing as well as Winnipeg was, if not better. Dallas has a really nice group of forwards, guys, and they have great goaltending in Kari Lehtinen. Their defense is a little bit shaky. But they also have the benefit of a guy like Tyler Seguin. Tyler Seguin, arguably their top forward. You could argue Jamie Benn. You could argue him. But he gets to rest. He gets to sit at home. You know, will that be negated by the fact that Nikushkin and Ben, his line mates, were over there? In any event, just on paper, I think Dallas is the biggest impediment for the Winnipeg Jets to make the playoffs. And the games against Dallas, if you go back and you see how they fare against Dallas over the course of the year, that might be the difference between making the playoffs and not making the playoffs.
Yeah, and the Jets are going to play Dallas once before the season ends.
Twice.
Oh, sorry, twice. Mm-hmm. And I'd have to agree with Richie. That line, and they put Nikushkin up there with Jamie Benn and Tyler Seguin, has been one of the best lines in the NHL. And Benn moved over. And you look at mm-hmm. what's happened with that team, and, you know, Kari Lehtinen's been great. The mm-hmm. defense has struggled. Sergei Gonchar, as we expected, hasn't had the impact. Goligoski struggled. Jordy Benn's been a bright spot. Brendan Dillon. But you look at that team, and they have more scoring than any of the other teams. Vancouver, you have to think, uh-huh. will be active at the trade deadline. Guys like Alex Burrows, David Booth, we'll talk about a lot about this Saturday leading up to the trade deadline. The Vancouver Canucks need a scorer. You've heard Vanek and Camilleri and others.
I can see, sorry for interrupting, and we'll talk, like you said, but I can see Vancouver being a seller at the trade deadline.
Yeah, I could too, but as he's great.
Depends what happens.
I think it makes a great point. Vancouver, Phoenix, and Nashville. all of them have trouble scoring goals.
Mm-hmm.
And I know Phoenix has 163 goals, but I mean, let's be honest here. Naturally, they don't have a lot.
Well, the topic of Vancouver, they don't have a lot to sell, though.
Well, they, you're right. They don't have as much as they had to sell 2 years ago.
Sedins aren't going anywhere, so.
No. But you look at you mentioned the Dallas Stars, and I think you can certainly make the argument that of the five teams battling for that final playoff spot,
yeah,
the Dallas Stars have the two best forwards on those five teams.
I agree with that.
I mean, Sagan and Ben. I mean, mm-hmm. you can make an argument that maybe, you know, Blake Wheeler's as good as one of those guys, but I don't think he is.
He's not.
Yeah. So I think it's, and I mean, maybe.
Blake Wheeler's good, but he's not as good as one of
right.
those.
Or maybe the Sedins, you know, find the fountain of youth again and get rejuvenated, but I think Ben and Sagan are going to be the key for the Dallas Stars, over the next 24 games.
And if you don't think Lindy Ruff leaning on them and in their ear telling them exactly that, this is what you played for, this is the opportunity, this is what you want. Sagan, you're playing right wing, second line, third line in Boston, your number one center, go prove it. Ben, you proved yourself at the Olympics, keep going. Of course he's going to be doing that for motivation. That's going to be very important for them. And also another thing is the other three lines, everybody on those three lines, this is to Tyson Nash's point last segment, everybody on those other three lines knows their job. A guy like Cody Eakin, he knows what he is expected from him. Ryan Garbutt, two Winnipeg guys, but they do a good job of what they need to do. And then you have Eric Cole and Ray Whitney, veteran guys who know they're not as good as they once were, but are still playing hard and allow that veteran presence in the dressing room.
Sure.
So there is no panic amongst the young players. They have a nice mix. Maybe they don't have that number two center who's a guy that a team like Boston or one of the other top teams has, Detroit, whatever it may be. Detroit's still a top team, but you see my point. Maybe Eakin has to play a little bit above his head. All that stuff. But they're only competing against the Jets, Phoenix, Nashville, Vancouver. Those teams aren't that good.
They don't have that. Those teams don't have that number
That's
two
right.
center. They all have guys playing a little bit over their head as well. Let's head to break. We'll continue on looking at the schedules of all the teams battling for the final playoff spot. You're listening to NHL Midweek. We're live on TSN 1290.
You're listening to
The Illegal Curve Hockey Show.
The podcast
on TSN1290.ca.
Welcome back to NHL Midweek. This segment is brought to you by Dr. Les Rikus and the Linden Market Dental Center. Whether an elite athlete or a weekend warrior wearing a proper fitting, custom-made mouth guard designed for you by Dr. Les Rikus and the Linden Market Dental Center, it's an essential part of your protective equipment. Give yourself peace of mind protection as well as facial, teeth, and mouth protection. Contact the Linden Market Dental Center 204-487-2226 or online at lindenmarketdentalcenter.com. Gentlemen, we're talking about the playoff race in the Western Conference, five teams battling for what we assume will be one final playoff spot. And we'd mentioned before the break that the Winnipeg Jets have the most difficult of the schedules. The teams that they play against, the 22 games remaining, their opponents have a 529 win percentage.
Well, let me get in here with Dallas's schedule.
Okay.
This is not a hard schedule.
It's the weakest of all the five teams.
Let's go over it. We'll just go over it. Write it down. Carolina, then Tampa.
Well, hang on. Two against Carolina.
Well, I'm just going to go based on chronological order here.
Okay, sure.
I'm going to go through all 22, four of them.
24 games.
Carolina, then Tampa.
Yeah.
Bad team. I mean, Tampa Bay's not a bad team, but they're not a great team. It's not an unbeatable team. Carolina's not a great team. Tampa's okay. Buffalo's terrible. Columbus, blah. Vancouver's struggling. Minnesota, solid. Columbus again. Then St. Louis. So that's their first tough game, really, there.
Mm-hmm.
St. Louis. Calgary is not great. Winnipeg, they're competing with. Pittsburgh. So Pittsburgh, St. Louis are really the upper echelon teams they're playing. Philadelphia, not upper echelon. Ottawa, then Winnipeg. Chicago, then Nashville, St. Louis, Washington. That's four upper echelon teams. St. Louis twice, Chicago once, and Pittsburgh. Then you play Washington, Carolina, Tampa Bay, Florida, Nashville, St. Louis, and Phoenix. They really have five upper echelon teams that they're facing. That's it.
They play the Blues three times. They have a .684 win percentage. They face the Penguins once, and their .690 win percentage. And what was the other
Chicago
team you mentioned? Chicago with their .583 win percentage. Everybody else is, Tampa's got a good winning percentage.
Average to below average.
Yeah. Everybody else is decidedly meh. You know, in terms of, like, Dallas, you looks at that schedule, and I mean, you know, it's the final playoff spot is there for Dallas's taking.
But you know, if you heard Mike Hyka on HNL today, it's been the story the past few years. I think it's a different story in terms of the roster construction.
This different team head has a coach, too.
Yeah, different head of coach when Lindy Ruff's a good coach. But the team is not an older team, Ezzy, looking to not fade. It's a younger team looking to get better. Yeah. If you watch them play, they're getting better.
Right, and they have the veterans. You mentioned last segment, Richie, Eric Cole, Ray Whitney. Those guys have insulated the youngsters. But the core of this team going forward is Jamie Benn, Nikushkin, Tyler Seguin, Jordy Benn, Brendan Dillon. So, and it's interesting, too, about the schedule. Nine of their games are against Eastern Conference teams. So they have a lot of games against Eastern Conference teams, but they have the easiest schedule. And if you're the Winnipeg Jets and you're looking at your schedule, and obviously they're focused on the Phoenix Coyotes first and foremost tomorrow, but you're looking at your schedule, those two games against the Dallas Stars, if the Phoenix Coyotes game is a four-point game, or those eight-point games, those are important games because I think we agree the Phoenix Coyotes are less of a threat than the Dallas Stars. No offense to the Phoenix Coyotes.
It's true.
They just don't have the firepower that the Stars have.
The Jets would say that on paper, now that they're healthy, now the Jets are, or the Jets would say we're a better team than the Phoenix Coyotes.
I agree with that.
That game in December in Winnipeg, I think it was 5-2. Was it 5-2, 6-2? Maybe we'll check that.
That last season?
That Dallas
won. When was the last time we played the NHL?
Yeah. The game that I know you
remember. You're talking about, it was a Saturday afternoon.
It was a Saturday afternoon. I was in the stands for that game.
So you don't remember the second or third periods. You were so drunk.
Right.
The game that Anthony Peluso, the game was tied. Peluso took the five-minute boarding penalty.
Yes.
Dallas got two power play goals, and they won handily at that point.
That was one of the most dominating performances by any team at the MTS Center this year. And that at the time, the Dallas Stars weren't in a playoff spot. So they can play, and we've seen what Nikushkin can do. We've seen what Jamie Benn can do, both in the NHL and at the Olympics. And we've seen what Tyler Seguin can do. All those guys got on the score sheet in that game. And they have the ability, if you're off, you're sleeping, you take a couple shifts off, those guys will burn you. And they might lack the depth of other teams in the Western Conference. If Dallas makes the playoffs, they're out quickly. I could see them getting swept. But we're talking about Dallas making that last playoff spot, because this is a team, they haven't had success in a long time.
Mm-hmm.
This isn't the Brett Hull, Pat Verbeek, Marty Turco days.
Pat Verbeek, good reference. Benoit Hogue, Dave Reed.
They've been out of the playoffs for a long time now, and they're trying to get back in there. And the Jets, I would have to agree, going back to last segment, there's going to be some teams. Vancouver's obviously going to make a push, but the way they've been playing, losing all those games before the Olympics, they don't scare me that much.
I'm not sure Vancouver's even going to make a push. They're going to be without Ryan Kesler. He's just too banged up after his Olympics.
Yeah, is his heart broken?
I find it interesting that he supposedly broke his hand in the Olympics, played for another few games, and then came back to Vancouver and couldn't go again.
I don't want to talk about Ryan Kesler.
Okay.
There's nobody more irritating to me than Ryan Kesler.
You take him on your team, though.
Nah. I don't think so.
Well,
I've said that before, but he just bothers me too much to have him anywhere near my team if I have a team.
Unfortunately, there's major injury concerns. We're talking 3 years now in a row.
Well, that's the thing. And the other end, you know, there's rumors and that he's on the trade block. You know, I saw just on TSN they had they listed a few teams of possible destinations. I've heard other teams could possibly be interested as well. But you better be willing to take on an injury risk, as you mentioned, and that's a significant injury risk. And his personality, I'm not convinced that personality meshes with a lot of players on his own team.
You could very well be right about that. The Canucks will open up their post-Olympic schedule tonight against the Blues, a game you can see on TSN.
Well, this is the thing, Drew. If I look at the schedule and look at the rosters, Dallas is the favorite to me. And if I have to take the five teams and put it in percentages, I think Dallas probably has a 30 to 35% chance of making it. I like the roster. I like the coach. I like the net minding, and I like the schedule. And the Jets have a tough schedule.
Yeah.
And you look at it, they play LA twice, they play San Jose, they play Anaheim, they play Boston, they play Pittsburgh. We talked about these are not, and these are when you, if these are, these teams are getting going now. You didn't, you're not, you know, you're not drawing them tomorrow or the next day when they have a bunch of guys, you know, Doughty and Kopitar and Carter coming back from the Olympics, or San Jose with Vlasic and Marlowe. You're catching them right when they have 10 games to go before the playoffs.
and they're not willing to accept any letdown games at that point in time because they're gearing up for the what they expect to be a long playoff run.
I think it was Chicago in the last Olympics. I think their last six or seven games before, 10 games, whatever it was, before the playoffs, they pumped it up. But right after, they struggled a bit.
Sure. Understandable. Yeah. I mean, the concept of the post-Olympics letdown. I think one thing the Jets have going for them in that they, you know, with regards to controlling their own destiny, is of all the teams sort of battling for the final playoff spots, and I also included Minnesota and Los Angeles when I did this, the Jets have 9 games against teams in the playoff race.
How do you control destiny?
You don't, obviously.
Okay, sorry.
I think you've actually said that on the show before.
Yeah.
But, you know, of the teams in the playoff race...
I love Jim Houston, but why does he always say scoreless tie? Could it be scoreless win? Anyhow, sorry.
Of all the teams in the playoff race... The Jets have the most games against those teams. Mm-hmm. They play 9 games against the teams in the playoff race. Phoenix plays 8, Vancouver and Dallas play 7, and Nashville plays 6. So the Jets, I mean, obviously they need to win more than just 9 games. Mm-hmm. But you take care of business in those 9 games against the teams that are in and around you in the standings.
Not easy.
Not easy.
No.
But, I mean, like you said, you got the 2 against the Kings.
Colorado twice. I mean, Colorado ain't easy. Look at those forwards.
No, Colorado I didn't even include in those
I know.
Those
that's
games.
What I'm saying.
Yeah, it's a very difficult schedule.
The best Jets... part about the schedule, again, is that the first 9 out of the 12 games right. are at home.
That's right.
And the first few games aren't easy. You've that's got right. Nashville and the Islanders and Phoenix. Not the greatest teams. So that's mm-hmm. the good part. The bad part is... You've got a lot of good teams coming up after that. You've got that road trip. That road trip could be a killer if they're in a position where it factors in. Because if they don't get wins at home before that, then in late March, the season might be over. So it's not going to be easy. But this team, again, going into this stretch of games here, these last 22 games, was playing the best hockey of the season. Arguably the best hockey we've seen since they came back, really. Since Paul Maurice took over. This team has beaten the Ducks and they've beaten the Blackhawks, so we've kept it close against the Blues, kept it close against the Sharks. So will the Olympics take some of that momentum away, or are they going to be able to keep that up? Big question there. It's not going to be easy.
Nobody really played there. I mean, Pavlik played a bit, didn't play a ton. Frolik played a bit, not a ton. Wheeler hardly got 3 shifts in. And Jokinen
probably
played
had
a bit.
The biggest role,
but he's the third line center, so I mean, he's not going to play a ton anyways.
Yeah, I mean, you're right.
I mean, he does play a lot under Maurice, but still, he's not going to play a ton.
It's not like you're going to be crippling. It's not like you're going to play crippling minutes in the Olympics.
Kane, Bogosian, you mentioned Trouba, Enstrom. None of these guys played. They've probably went to Mexico, got a little tan, and they should be well ready, you know, rested and ready to go.
Well, you mentioned Evander Kane. That's another plus. That's mm-hmm. another thing that the Jets have going for them. Jim Slater, Matt Halischuk, even though they might not be coming back into the lineup tomorrow night, Paul Maurice said he's probably, with the exception of Kane, going to keep the same lineup. They're getting healthy. And for the Jets, a team that doesn't have a lot of veteran depth in the AHL, it's important to have a guy like Jim Slater who's mm-hmm. going to be coming back. It's important to have a guy like Matt Halischuk coming back.
Slater more than Halischuk.
Yeah, I like Halischuk's game.
But Slater's defensively and face-offs, they miss him.
That's right. He's their face-off guy, and they haven't had him since game 8 of the season or whatever it is. So, I mean, there are positives for the Jets in that they're getting healthy, and they've been able to go on this streak without having, you know, Evander Kane for a lot of it. So, I mean, you know, your top 2 lines are now set, and you're ready to go, and those guys should be relatively well-rested, like we said. You know, 9 games. I mean, it's the next 9 games will really tell you what you need to know if that Western
just tell you if you should still have hope after the 9 games.
Yeah, I mean, you got 7 of those 9 at home. Those are the this is the easy part of a difficult schedule.
Right.
I mean, how many of those 9 do you have to win? Do you figure you got to go 6-2-1?
Yeah, minimum. Yeah.
I mean, so you expect to beat Phoenix tomorrow.
Over those, Nashville, Islanders, Ottawa, Vancouver, Rangers. Yeah, you gotta go 9. You gotta go 6-2-1.
Yeah, I mean, there's nobody there that's really much better than you are. The Kings, have been struggling, but you beat them on home ice once this year.
Yeah, Drew, the Kings have been struggling, and they've had issues putting the puck in the net and some other things, but I still don't want to play the Kings.
No, of course you don't want to play the Kings. The interesting part of that game is the day after the trade deadline. It's a 6 o'clock game. On a Thursday. It'll be curious to see what the LA Kings lineup looks like at that point, if they add a player like we expect.
Yeah, maybe they'll add a player to score up front. They could certainly use that.
It's not going to be a snap of the fingers. They're not going to be all of a sudden an offensive juggernaut.
Marcus Johansson's still in Sweden, for God's sake. The guy might not even be there for that game. The other thing, Drew,
Marcus Johansson.
I'm saying like the travel and the visas and all that stuff takes a while.
Yeah, but he doesn't play for
the... I know, but the point was is that Johansson can't get a visa to get back into North America right now. So you think a guy gets traded on Wednesday evening will be able to get a visa to get into Canada right away?
Apparently at customs, though, he was actually giving them like a visa credit card.
No, oh, interesting.
Let's go to break.
Hold on.
Okay.
Our trade deadline preview.
Richie, we can't end the segment on that.
Yeah, we can't end it on that. Our trade deadline preview is on Saturday.
That's right.
It's going to be 3 hours.
8 a.m. here on TSN 1290.
Preview the whole league.
Yeah. NHL trade deadline preview show.
I'd be shocked if the Jets make two trades.
I would agree with you.
Maybe shocked if they make two trades.
Setoguchi. I could see them.
Maybe. And then they'll get some guy like him for the same thing they traded him for.
Yeah. I mean, Setoguchi would be the guy, but I don't think they're going to trade.
I don't know if they make any trades. Well,
again, though, it has a lot to... And I really do believe this. I don't think if they... I mean, there's four games before then, right? So I think, depending on what
three
happens
games,
there...
Three games.
And then one on the Saturday, right? So next Saturday and this Saturday, but if
what,
we're...
What's Saturday,
yeah, what does Saturday have to do with anything?
The point being
trade deadline TV show is this Saturday.
Just go to break.
I hear what's the point.
Just go to break.
You're listening to NHL Midweek. We're live on TSN 1290.
You're listening to
The Illegal Curve Hockey Show.
The podcast
on TSN1290.ca.
It's that time of year in the NHL world with the trade deadline 1 week from tonight. Louis Jean from TVA in Montreal just tweeted the following. Sources say Ryan Kesler requested a trade some time ago and wants out of Vancouver. Told Canucks don't want to trade him, but may not have a choice. Maybe tough to move Kesler before the deadline. Draft may be more likely. Vancouver would be looking for a hockey trade, not picks.
Not a baseball trade.
It's good that they clarified that part of it.
Yeah, because I want to make sure it's not a baseball trade. Well, let's start with Ryan Kesler. He wants to make sure he's the first guy jumping off the sinking ship, I assume.
Yeah, good job refraining from calling him a rat there.
I'm not a big Ryan Kesler fan. $5 million left on this year's... $5 million being paid this year, cap hit, and then the next 2 years. This is a guy who's going to go to a team, guys, who wants to compete now. And that is interesting because what Louis Jean really means there by hockey trade is I think, elaborate a little bit, is that it needs to be players. So the team who acquire Kesler, based on his injury history, wants to win now. What is the team trading off their roster that's helping them win now, right now? Sure. If that makes sense. So it's going to be interesting. I as I said, the TSN had four teams up there. I've heard of some other teams that have been interested in Kesler. I think he will get dealt. I don't think it needs to be at the draft, because if you're Vancouver and he wants out and he's not going to help you and it's a sinking ship there, then you want to get rid of him as ASAP. And his attitude...
I just said it. He played through whatever his hand injury is in Sochi, and all of a sudden he's back with the Canucks, and he can't play.
I mean, there's some other guys who kind of do that too, Drew, and I bet you will come out with injuries in the next little bit. But I that's a fair point.
Yeah.
That's a fair point. And I don't know. He can play. We know he can play. But he has a lot of talking for a guy who's never won anything. I'll put it that way.
And... it hasn't gone from bad to worse in Vancouver. It's gone from bad to really bad. And when the Vancouver Canucks were in Winnipeg and they were in the middle of that losing streak and Torts was on a suspension, it was bad. And we saw the injury with Henrik Sedin. He came back. He wasn't ready to come back. Didn't play for Sweden. Daniel Sedin, as we know, his season has really taken a nosedive since Henrik Sedin went out. We've had the other injuries. We've had all of these players seemingly having the worst years of their careers, really. With the exception of Dan Hamhuis and Roberto Luongo, there haven't been any bright spots. They're out of the playoffs, and as you mentioned, Drew, you think that the Vancouver Canucks aren't really even a contender to put up a fight, and I wouldn't really disagree with that. Ryan Kesler, all the success, and they were one game away from winning the Stanley Cup in 2011. It's really incredible how things have gone there, because Tortorella came in, he was going to bring structure, he was going to get them to play better defensively, and that team has just completely imploded. And it's not surprising that he's asking out, because he might see things that even though we see bad things, he might see worse things that are going on that team. Because if you think about the whole Tortorella, Calgary, the suspension there, and the throw in the injuries, as we just mentioned, could this season have gone any worse? Not that we expected the Vancouver Canucks to be a playoff, a Stanley Cup contender, but I definitely thought they were going to be a playoff team. And up until a month ago, they were. But it just seems to be getting worse and worse and worse.
Let me ask you guys this question. There's two Ryans that are supposedly on the market, Ryan Kesler and Ryan Callahan. Mm-hmm. Both of them sort of play a very sacrifice-yourself type of style. Which one would you rather have? If they're both supposedly available at the trade deadline.
Well, one's a center, one's a right winger. Kessler's a center, Callahan's a right winger. I think Kessler's shown more natural ability to score in the past. He has, certainly has. I mean, he scored one season, he scored 41 goals. Although that's probably an aberration. He's more of a 20 to 25 goal scorer. He's a more talented guy. I think Callahan fits more into the team than does Kessler. Callahan's ask is a pending UFA, so the situations, Drew, are just too different.
I guess, but if you took that, I guess, are you saying, contract situation aside, who would you take?
Yeah, because after this year, it's likely that they're going to be making similar amounts of money based on what Callahan's supposedly asking for.
But the term is so important, right? If Kessler's 2 years left, he's more appealing than Callahan, who wants $6 or $7 million a year, $6.5 million, like crazy money for a guy who's not that good offensively. Both of them will make probably a little bit more money than sometimes their offensive potential should have earned, because it's that whole what they bring is the character, if faceoffs or blocking shots, whatever it may be for both of them. Both of them can get injured though because of the way they play. I wouldn't sell the farm for either, to be honest with you.
I'd take Ryan Callahan, and Ryan Kesler, as Richie mentioned, he has the higher offensive upside. You watch Ryan Callahan, he was on the U.S. team in the Olympics. He'll sacrifice his body, and maybe he'll ask for a lot of money, and I would take him. He's a better team player. He's a better leader. I think Kesler, since the Stanley Cup playoffs, and that was his peak. That was like the zenith for Ryan Kesler.
Uh-huh. It was.
And he was a Conn Smythe candidate for that Vancouver Canucks team. He really was. And since then, he's had injuries, sure, but he's really had trouble really with himself. He's really battled his own demons, and he hasn't really been able to overcome that. And, Callahan, he just seems to be asking for too much money. And really, the question has become now, because Glenn Sather isn't going to offer him that money, how many other GMs that know that he wants this amount of money are actually going to pay him? Well, and that's the problem. That's, I think, limiting the amount of teams that want to trade for him.
Kesler, I mean, Kessler's a more talented player. I don't think there's a question about it, but I do agree that the dynamics of acquiring him and acquiring Callahan are very different. And you drop Callahan, you can drop Callahan into any roster and not have an issue. Contract status. I don't think you can drop Kesler into any roster and not have an issue.
Personality-wise, is that what you're saying?
Yeah.
He's abrasive a little bit, might not fit into every locker room.
I mean, when you call out your own goaltender in the middle of the second intermission of the 2010 Olympics, like Roberto Luongo, what's your deal?
I know he'd say that he's playing for the country at that point in time, but
so you're still playing for the country, and don't disrespect your teammates.
Well, that's just it. You never heard another NHL player.
Drew Doughty was said today, if you read his quotes, he said today that he was chirping Jonathan Quick about not beating him in that game and scoring on him, but that they were chirping a little bit during the game. But the point was, it was lighthearted. It was
playful.
Yeah, it was different. And then that's, do you want to go to, I don't know, that guy just does a lot of talking for me, for a guy who's not wanting anything. So I'm not so sure I'm going that close to him. That's my personal opinion.
The Buffalo Sabres are playing right now, a game you can see on TSN2. Jonas Enroth is getting the start in goal for them. This will be a quick one. Friday, they play at home to the San Jose Sharks. Is Ryan Miller still a member of the Buffalo Sabres come Friday?
Yeah, Friday he is. You want to push it down to the wire, but they're trading him. You know they're going to trade him. Tim Murray's going to deal him. And Ryan Miller is a good goalie, but there's a little too much drama about Ryan Miller. He hasn't been relevant in couple years now, eh? Like,
well, he hasn't been relevant because the team's been so bad. But the way he's played, you watched them play yesterday against Carolina, and I did. There was one guy responsible for that win. It was Ryan Miller. He kept them in that
game.
Good
player, he's going to go to St. Louis, I think. That's where I think he goes, and I think he'll succeed. I think any goalie with his skill level will succeed in a system like St. Louis. But then it will be interesting to see if he goes somewhere like that, can he take that team to the next level when it matters most?
Even at his age, top five goalie.
Well, I don't know about that.
Top 10?
Top 10, probably still.
We'll know how it all plays out next Wednesday as we wrap up the NHL trade deadline. Of course, Saturday, 8 a.m., the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. It is our NHL trade deadline preview show. A big thank you to tonight's guests, Corey Massasak from NHL.com and Tyson Nash, Phoenix Coyotes color analyst. Thanks to our sponsors, the Certified General Accountants of Manitoba, Rumors Restaurant and Comedy Club, and the Linden Market Dental Center. You can follow us on Twitter at IllegalCurve, Facebook.com/IllegalCurve, and our website is IllegalCurve.com. In case you missed any of the show, it will be available for download on iTunes and on TSN1290.ca. For producer Michael Remus, for my colleagues Richard Pollock and Ezra Ginsberg, I'm your host, Drew Mandel. If it's Wednesday, it's NHL Midweek with the Illegal Curve Hockey Show.
You've been listening to
the Illegal Curve Hockey Show.
The podcast.
Catch the Illegal Curve Hockey Show live Saturdays on TSN 1290 and TSN1290.ca.